You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to the Taking a Walk podcast, hosted by Buzz Knight. You can keep up with Taking a Walk if you follow us at takingawalk.com, Apple Podcasts, the podcast playground, or wherever you get your podcasts. On previous Taking a Walk episodes, Buzz has talked with authors who dig deep into music history stories. These have included David Leaf, who wrote about the genius of Brian Wilson, and Joel Selvin, who wrote about legendary red rocker Sammy Hagar. On this episode, Buzz welcomes author Scott Shea, talking about his new book, All the Leaves Are Brown, about the twisted world of the band The Mamas and the Papas. Join Buzz Knight as he hosts Scott Shea next on Taking a Walk.
Hi, Scott. Nice to be with you, albeit on a virtual edition of Taking a Walk.
Good deal.
So how could one band that was so immensely talented and successful been so dramatically screwed up in so many other ways?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, I think just humanity plays a part in that. So, you know, there was the old sex, drugs, and rock and roll idiom, right? And these four really kind of took it to the hilt. I say this a lot, and I hate to just kind of, it sounds like I'm bashing the group, but I'm really not. It's just, the dysfunction between the members, following the revelation of Denny's fling with Michelle, and it's really kind of resting on their laurels. The all four of them had been members of various folk groups and had toured the country and, on buses and stayed in cheap motels and wore the same outfits days on end, and that's a lot of hard work. And I think when they got to that level that the Mamas and the Papas was at, they really kind of got a little lazy. You know, they didn't. They only wanted to tour on weekends and in warm climates. You know, and they canceled a lot of shows. And that's not a recipe for staying together very long. You know, the Beatles, the Stones, the Birds, any group, Bob Dylan, any group that really is a 60s legend, they put the hard work in. They went out and met the people, being on the road inspired their songwriting and gave us some really great stuff. And unfortunately, the Mamas and the Papas didn't really do that.
Who was whispering in their ear that could have been a good influence?
Well, Lou Adler, for sure. You know, and I know, the record label, they really wanted them out on the road. It wasn't, you know, something they weren't at all enamored with their approach and with the dysfunction. And you know, they had to kind of tread lightly because there was they were aware of the relationship dysfunction within the group. And you know, here they're walking the line of trying to get them out to promote it, but not getting them to not break up at the same time. You know, so but definitely Lou Adler was a force that really helped them and got them back on their feet somewhat.
But he obviously was doing other things, so he couldn't spend full time really managing the dysfunction.
Yeah, you know, not long after they signed with Dunhill, you know, he sold it to ABC and walked away with a cool million in his pocket. He and his four or five partners, mostly they were silent partners. So not long after they had signed, his influence could only carry so far. I mean, Dunhill for sure kept Lou on to be their manager and the producer. But you know, he could only go so far as with what the label was doing. So, but you know, I know he tried, and I know he loved John, and they were close friends. And in the studio, they were a dynamic duo. You know, but as far as getting John on the road and saying, "Hey, man, we got to put the work in," he didn't do too well there.
So let's go through each band member, because you paint a tremendous picture in the book, inside and out of each of them. So I'd like to hear your take and go through the lineup. First, John Phillips, talk about what a complex figure he was.
Well, he has maybe the most complex personal life out of all of them, and that's really saying something, you know. I'm not even talking about which came later, you know, the allegations from his daughter Mackenzie. But even back in those days, you know, he was into drugs. You know, in the late 70s, he got busted for being a drug dealer. But that behavior had gone on in the early 60s when they were in a folk group, and he was dispensing pills to everybody. You know, he had these relationships worked out with these chemists, so he was definitely you know, in over his head with drugs from the onset. But he was an incredible musician, and you know, really underrated, I think. I think the reason why he's underrated was he wasn't as prolific as some of the others. I really put him up there with Brian Wilson as far as the way he arranged songs. I mean, they both really, you know, Brian was into the Four Freshmen, you know, growing up, and really kind of patterned his rock and roll after them. And similarly, John was into the High Lows, which was another singing quartet, kind of jazzy from the early to mid 50s, and they inspired his writing. But like I said, John just wasn't as prolific, and so he doesn't get the same kind of accolades that somebody like Brian Wilson gets.
And one of the things I discovered that I didn't know is his piece of the action, if you will, with the legendary Monterey Pop Festival. Talk about John Phillips as sort of a business person in that regard.
He really was. You know, when he focused on something, I mean, look out. He put his all into it, and that includes the Monterey Pop Festival. That was brought to him by a couple guys, Alan Parisier and a guy named Benjamin Shapiro. And they had wanted to put on a show earlier in 1967, I think in the winter, like February or March, to raise money to bail out the kids or to pay for the defense of kids who were arrested during the Sunset Strip riots in Los Angeles after the curfews had been changed and there was a lot of rioting going on, and gave us songs like For What It's Worth by Buffalo Springfield. But so they wanted to do a larger one, like an outdoor festival in Monterey, where there was a jazz festival like every other year or so. And so they got it for 2 days, and they didn't really have anybody. They wanted the Beatles and the Stones, but the Beatles had stopped touring, and the Stones were in legal nightmares with their drug busts, so they couldn't even go anywhere if they wanted to. So Derek Taylor, who was the Beatles' publicist, had moved to Los Angeles and was working for the Byrds, and he had suggested to them the Mamas and the Papas. They're the hottest thing going right now, and they're right in your backyard. So they approached John and, through some cajoling, got him on board, and then he saw the potential of it and really took it over and made it what the Monterey Pop Festival that we know today, which is the father of the rock festival, was really his idea. It was a not-for-profit venture, and he had all cutting-edge artists. It wasn't like a Dick Clark caravan of stars. It was, you know, they got a lot of those San Francisco groups like the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane, and then the two top British groups in that time, like the Who and the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and, you know, gave us an Otis Redding, you know, and gave us just this incredible festival that we're still revering today.
And he bought out one of the partners, ultimately, too, of the festival, didn't he?
Yeah, Ben Shapiro. He was not thrilled with the nonprofit aspect. So he did a great thing, a smart thing. He held out, and they just ended up buying him out for $50,000. So he walked away with $50,000 in his pocket, and they got what they wanted.
Let's talk about the only living member, the beautiful Michelle Phillips.
Yes, she was John's wife from 1960 to 1969. They had met when John, or 1962, I'm sorry. They had met in 1961 when John was in the Journeymen. It was his folk group that was on Capitol Records. And they went out to San Francisco to do a month stand at the Hungry Eye. Their management team was located out there, so they went out to be closer to them and really kind of stayed in that area. And Michelle was living there. She was a model. She was about 17 and had moved up there from Los Angeles with her friend Tamar Hodel, and whose father, George Hodel, was a prime suspect in the Black Dahlia murder. And so they met them at the Hungry Eye, and John, who was a habitual cheater on his wife at the time, Susie, just fell head over heels in love with her. So, and then, you know, and then they got married like a year or so later, and they started having marital troubles because Michelle had an affair, and I think John was reforming the New Journeyman, and he wanted Michelle a little closer to him, keep an eye on her, so he brought her in, and she was also pretty, could sing a little bit, you know, and but I really think their marriage is critical. I think if they hadn't gotten married, we wouldn't have the Mamas and the Papas. And, you know, she went on, she didn't really go on to keep singing. She became an actress, appeared in a lot of movies, was in Falcon Crest in the 80s, and, you know, has pretty much since retired. But, you know, like I said, maybe the greatest, one of the greatest songwriting muses in rock and roll history, as Monday, Monday, and Go Where You Want to Go, and I Saw Her Again, and even California Dreamin' were inspired by her.
Did you attempt to reach out to her for the book?
I did, yeah, I did. You know, she did not return my requests. I know she's very proprietary of that story, and, you know, and rightly and understandably so. That's, she's a big part of that story. You know, and when I approached her, I was not signed to a publishing deal. I did not have an agent, so I was just some random guy, you know, who worked at the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM, and you know, I can understand why she didn't. Why she didn't return my request, but nonetheless, she put out an autobiography in 1986 that really kind of detailed her time with the Mamas and the Papas. So I was able to glean a lot of her perspective from that.
Let's talk about Denny Doherty.
Denny was. Talking about underrated, Denny, I think, is one of the most underrated rock and roll voices. He had a great, great tenor, a great rock and roll tenor, more suited for rock and roll than folk music. He was in a folk band as well that was signed to Epic Records, and they were called the Halifax Three. They were all from Nova Scotia, Canada, and they had some minor success. But he and John met on a Hootenanny tour when John was with the Journeymen, and those two got very very close. They would like, they both smoked marijuana, and when the tour bus would come to a rest stop, they would go off in the bushes and you know, sneak a joint here and there. And but it drew them closer, and they really had a love for each other. And even after it came to light that Michelle and Johnny had Michelle and Denny had slept together, they were able to find a place of healing and remain friends. And they were friends through the rest of John's life.
So then let's talk about the great Cass Elliot.
Well, she was definitely the superstar of the group. Kind of came out of nowhere. I think when you look, you know, through the lens of history, she was, heavy set and not traditionally the traditional look of a female lead singer. But she had quite a voice, and she had a personality to match. You know, I think in many ways she had that to try to make up for, you know, for her weight, you know, which, and, you know, in her mind was probably a bigger deal than it was to others. But, you know, it was made, you know, it was made fun of a lot. You know, it's always brought up, and you watch her on TV shows and interviews and stuff like that. But she was an incredible talent. She also was in a folk group of the Big Three, and she had met Denny on tour as well, and she fell in love with him. He was a good looking guy, and she was really into him, but it was unrequited love. Denny loved her as a friend, but he was not into her romantically. And that was another thing that just really kind of gave the band its aura, you know, the love between Michelle or Denny and Cass, or the unrequited love. Over time, I think the behavior of all of them just kind of distanced her from them, and she was looking for a way out. And, as the Mamas and the Papas star began to fall, hers as a solo singer was rising because she was, when they were on stage, she was the spokesperson of the group. She was the one who told the stories while the band was tuning their instruments, you know, and that she had done that with her time with the Big Three. And, she was the breakout star when Dream a Little Dream of Me came out. It was credited to Mama Cass with the Mamas and the Papas. I think Dunhill Records saw the writing on the wall and wanted to move on with Cass, and they did. And she had a fairly successful solo career as a singer. It was probably not what they had hoped for. She didn't really have any smash number one successes, but her personality was such that she was on talk shows, a lot of talk shows. I mean, she did like Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin dozens of times. I believe she hosted Carson, filled in for him a couple times when he was, you know, he was always taken off. And she was on his show a lot. So I think had she lived, she may have become a very successful talk show host.
It's amazing that they, at least John Phillips, did not want her in the group. And it's also amazing that, even in one of their songs, you know, the line, no one's getting fat except Mama Cass. I mean, think about that in today's world.
I know, it's inconceivable, you know, but the funny thing was that, you know, she was in on the joke, and she knew John, and I think to her way of getting back at John, because they had a very tumultuous relationship, was to sing that line with as much vim and vigor as she could muster. And when you listen to it, she is really into that line, you know, and I think for us, it maybe kind of backfired on him, but for us, we benefited because it gives that song a little more pizzazz.
My understanding from talking to the great photographer Henry Diltz, who knew Mama Cass, was that she was an incredible sweetheart.
Oh, she was. I mean, you can just see it in the interviews that she gives. She's very endearing. And I think that's one reason why she was so successful in that realm, is that people like to hear her talk and like to, you know, it drew people closer to her. And it's, you could fall in love with her personality very, very, very easily. And, you know, and for my taste, I mean, I don't, you know, I know she didn't think so, and maybe she, by by other standards. I think she's an attractive woman too, but you know, she just had a great look about her and a great personality to boot, you know, and America fell in love. And unfortunately, not just America, but the world fell in love, and we lost her way too early, for, you know, at the age of 32 years old.
And then there was this moment with the band that I did not know about, the moment where the band kicked out Michelle Phillips for the affair that she was having with Gene Clark of the Byrds. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think once the dust settled from Denny and Michelle's fling, you know, Michelle stayed in the house where she and John had rented shortly after that came to light. And then, but John moved out and moved in with Denny. And then she, you know, she began this affair with Gene Clark, who she met through a mutual friend. And I think once that came to light, it was too much for John. It's just like, I can't deal with this. I think he told Denny and Mama Cass that it's either me or her. You know, and they couldn't afford to lose John. They could afford to lose Michelle, or so they thought, you know, because John was the prince. Without John, there is no mamas and papas, which is why he's really kind of a focal point of this book. You know, it's kind of like the Beach Boys. You write a book on the Beach Boys, it's going to be a lot of focus on Brian Wilson. So they did John fired her after a concert where Gene Clark was in attendance, and John noticed, and he fired her in the parking lot. And a few days later, they sent her a formal letter. And, it was the summer of 1966, so it lasted for about 2 months. And they brought in Jill Gibson, who was Lou Adler's girlfriend at the time. She had been the girlfriend of Jan Barry, of Jan and Dean. And they had broken up shortly before he had his car wreck that gave him resulted in some brain damage, but she was tall, another pretty blonde. She's a former model. She was very musical. She had written songs and worked in the studio with Jan and Dean, and had recorded a single herself. So she was kind of a natural replacement. But the thing was, you know, the Mamas and the Papas was a shared experience between four people, and I think it came to light during that time period, and that Jill, you know, Michelle wasn't a cog you could take out and replace. You know, she had been with them through thick and thin. They were together in New York. They were together at the Virgin Islands. She was with them when they moved back out to California and got signed to Dunhill, and they just couldn't replace that. And, you know, she had an edge to her that Jill didn't have. So he eventually brought her back in right there at the end of summer, and just resumed as normal. And it actually kind of kicked off a bit of a renaissance in John and Michelle's marriage. They bought that house in Bel Air and lived, as normally as they could for a little while. But then, you know, bad behaviors made their way back in, and they eventually divorced.
What was your conversation with Jill Gibson like for the book?
It was very, very introspective. She's a very deep person. She's an artist. You know, we communicated via email, and she would always reply in a very timely manner, and with great depth. She told me the great story of them meeting the Beatles. She was with them when they went to London in 1966 in the summer there, and really gave me a firsthand account of not only meeting the Beatles but several members of the Rolling Stones, and and it's all detailed in the book. People can will enjoy, and if you're a Beatles fan or a Rolling Stones fan, you'll certainly enjoy the Mamas and the Papas shared experience with them.
So do you ever think about the parallels of this band for a band that would eventually mature in some way and have its own legacy, the comparison between the Mamas and the Papas and the various affairs and Fleetwood Mac?
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. You know, it's funny, I didn't even really think of that writing it, and I'm a big Fleetwood Mac fan, so it's like, but it's like, yeah, they were kind of Fleetwood Mac before Fleetwood Mac, you know, and it was complicated. But, I know there's a mini-series out there based on the life of the tumultuous relationship of the most famous incarnation of Fleetwood Mac, because there were several, with Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks. And And you know, the movie, the book, my book has already been optioned for a movie or a limited edition series. And I really think the story of the Mamas and the Papas could be a great limited edition series, right there with Daisy Jones and the Six, because it writes itself, and there's a cliffhanger there already built in for every episode. But you know, it was the same thing, you know, just affairs and broken hearts and jealousies, and it was there before Fleetwood Mac even brought it to another level.
So Three Ring Circus, it was what it was, right?
Yeah, for sure, you know, and the three principals being, I guess you could say John is in there, but definitely Denny, Michelle, and Cass.
Yeah. So if you were their manager during that period, what would you have tried to do to steer the course?
Boy, that's a good question. You know, it's tough because, you know, we talk about the Monterey Pop Festival, how that really changed music. It really kind of gave us what we now refer to as classic rock, because that was right after that was all those San Francisco groups really started to hit, and albums became a bigger thing than singles. And you had power trios like Cream and the Jimi Hendrix Experience. And the Mamas and the Papas struggled to find a footing in that, and the very thing that they had created. You know, harmony groups didn't do too well in the post-Monterey world. You think of the Beach Boys and the Four Seasons and the Mamas and the Papas. And, you know, you eventually had this oldies revival that, you know, the Mamas and the Beach Boys and the Four Seasons were able to kind of get back, get their footing back, and really rejuvenate their careers. But the Mamas and the Papas just couldn't do that. So, I mean, I guess if I would have to get to work and just try to figure out how to make this four piece quartet that sings harmony relevant in this age. And that would have been a tough order. And we see it. The Mamas and the Papas, their fourth album, The Papas and the Mamas, not the greatest title in the world. It was a good album, and it came out right there in 1968 during that time. But it's not very memorable. You know, there's no real super standout tracks. There's good tracks on it. There's fan favorites for sure. But nothing like what had come before it, like Creaky Alley or California Dreamin' or I Saw Her Again. So I think if I were their manager, I don't know if I would have been any better than Lou Adler or whoever else came in, Bobby Roberts and all those other guys who came in. But I would just definitely say we got to focus on finding our footing here and how we're going to stay relevant in this era.
Might have been a visit to an addiction counselor possibly, too.
I don't know. And remember, that time period, it was hip to be on drugs.
True.
Well, Scott, congratulations on All the Leaves Are Brown, how the Mamas and the Papas came together and broke apart, your new book on Backbeat, and congratulations on it, and thank you for being on Taking a Walk.
Well, thank you, Buzz. I really appreciate you having me on, and if listeners want to, you know, learn, buy the book, and so you can go to my website, scottshaeauthor.com. Shea is spelled S-H-E-A, and I'll give you links to Amazon and Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, and the audiobook just dropped the other day. So if that's your preferred method of getting through a book, you can pick that up as well.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Taking a Walk with Buzz Knight is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
See new things. Try new things. Go back centuries while living in the moment. Forge new paths while discovering old ones. Pedal, paddle, and paint while trekking, tasting, and tailoring experiences that transform you into a better version of yourself. Immerse yourself in the world by activating your mind, your heart, and your body on a river cruise exclusively from Avalon Waterways. Save with limited time offers at avalonwaterways.com. Avalon is cruising. Elevated.